Hello, I'm Eric Huang. You're listening to Saint Podcast, a podcast that explores the always fascinating and often controversial lives of the saints. This is a history and culture podcast that traces the origins of morality tales of the saints, or hagiographies, through queer and feminist stories, ancient legends and lore, art history, and pop culture. This bonus episode is about a saint whose holy day is also a secular holiday, a day in which couples around the world buy each other flowers, chocolates, and other tokens of love. Facebook statistics suggest something else is brewing beneath the romantic dinners. The 2 weeks immediately before and after the feast day record the highest change in relationship status from dating to single. The irony of all this makes sense because the original hagiography of this martyr from ancient Rome had nothing to do with romantic love whatsoever. This is the story of Saint Valentine, the ersatz patron of love. Catholic legends are replete with the sensual. There's the phenomenon of divine ecstasy, which has its roots in ancient rituals to induce an altered consciousness, an ecstatic state. Saint Gregory of Nyssa, a 4th century bishop from a region that is today part of Turkey, defined Christian ecstasy as a personal connection with God, a closeness and union he compared to flight and intoxication. Many mystics through the ages have had divine ecstasies that are as excruciatingly painful as they are pleasurable. Saint Teresa of Avila, whom we'll meet in a future mystics episode, described her experiences as mystical and orgasmic expressions of divine love. Sensuality and romantic love are ubiquitous in Christian art. It was during the Renaissance when an idealized realism, inspired by a revival of ancient Greek and Roman techniques, tastes, and values, saw a proliferation of Christian figures in the erotic poses of their pagan predecessors. Eve and Mary Magdalene were painted as Christian Aphrodites and Venuses. Saint Sebastian and Christ himself were reimagined as youthful, bare-chested Apollos. A young Saint John the Baptist was recast as a primal god of the wilderness, a Bacchus-like youth, half-clothed in a hermit's animal skins. Many of these paintings were commissioned by wealthy bankers, cardinals, and monarchs as devotional images to hang in private chapels. The beautiful bodies and faces of these painted saints were the likenesses of their lovers. Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Raphael, Caravaggio, all employed their lovers to represent sacred figures. Leonardo da Vinci's young lover Salai was the face of Saint John the Baptist in a painting commissioned by a wealthy patron. It shows a smiling Salai who bears an uncanny resemblance to the Mona Lisa. The youth stands against a dark background that suggests nighttime or perhaps the darkness inside a hermit's cave. Salai wears only an animal skin draped over his left shoulder, which merges with his luxurious long curly hair. He raises his right hand in a gesture pointing up to heaven. His left hand cradles a rustic crucifix. Da Vinci wrote in his diaries of the unholy desires the painting evoked in the buyer, who confessed to kissing the work of art. The wealthy patron soon returned to Da Vinci's studio and paid the master painter to immediately remove all religious symbols, downgrading the holy hermit saint to a secular shepherd boy. Salai's pose is unaltered. He no longer carries a cross, though, and he stands before a sunlit landscape of trees. He still points up, but given the new outdoor scene, it might be to the mountains in the background, right behind him, not necessarily to heaven. The altered painting, removed of all Christian symbols, allowed the patron to enjoy the work of art as he wished, whilst minimizing the risk of heresy. Unfortunately, it was still too much to bear. He threw the painting into a river. Head to the Saint Podcast website to compare the before and after paintings of Salai as Saint John the Baptist. Both are copies of the original now lost to the river. The artist Raphael was notorious for his sexual appetites. The greatest love of his life was a woman named Margherita Luti, nicknamed affectionately as La Fornarina, which means the little baker. Her father was a baker. Raphael painted a scandalous nude portrait of her. She wears an exotic Eastern headdress. A diaphanous wisp of a veil is draped around her midsection, framing her stomach beneath it, like a pastry under a glass case. She's topless. Her right hand cups her left breast. The nude figure evokes Venus or Aphrodite. It's very Eastern, very pagan. La Fornarina sits in front of a dark myrtle bush, sacred to these ancient divinities of love. A decorative band on her left arm bears Raphael's signature, a secret sign, perhaps, that La Fornarina and Raphael might have been a couple. X-ray studies of the painting conducted between 2000 and 2001 deepened the mystery of the relationship between the painter and the baker. The scans revealed an overpainted square-cut ruby ring on La Fornarina's third left finger. Is the covered-up ring evidence for a wedding? Raphael was engaged to Maria Bibiena, the niece of a powerful Medici cardinal, a member of the hugely wealthy dynasty from Florence who bankrolled the Renaissance. Historians speculate that Raphael's friend and assistant, Giulio Romano, painted over the ring after Raphael's death to keep this illicit union a secret. La Fornarina's face can be seen in many paintings by her lover Raphael. She appears as Saint Cecilia in the work we discussed in the Martyrs episode, Saint Cecilia, the Blind Patron of Music. La Fornarina also modeled as the Virgin Mary in several of Raphael's paintings. According to the 16th century biographer Giorgio Vasari, Raphael was totally consumed by his love and lust for La Fornarina. When the banker Agostino Chigi commissioned Raphael to decorate his palazzo, Raphael convinced Chigi, who shared the artist's sexual appetites, to set up La Fornarina in an apartment at the palazzo so that the couple could make love between bouts of painting. Raphael was rumored to have died from exhaustion from too much sex, ironically on Good Friday. Caravaggio is infamous for painting sex workers as sacred figures. Felida Melandroni was a courtesan in Rome, possibly Caravaggio's lover as well. Caravaggio immortalized Felida as Mary Magdalene, St. Catherine of Alexandria, and the biblical hero Judith, who defeated the enemy general Holofernes by seducing him, then cutting off his head. Wealthy men paid handsomely for paintings of Felida, as well as artworks that feature the likenesses of the most popular male sex workers. Francesco Boneri, one of Caravaggio's male lovers, nicknamed Cecco, but referred to behind his back as Caravaggio's fuckboy, appeared twice as a nearly nude young St. John the Baptist. Caravaggio also painted Cecco as the angel-like Cupid. The Virgin Mary has also been eroticized, particularly in paintings featuring her milk. We explored this in the bonus episode about St. Bernard, who wrote his Mariologies and other theological works when a sculpture miraculously came to life to squirt a jet of milk into his mouth. Paintings of the Virgin Mary nursing the baby Jesus are called Madonna Lactans. Lacto means milk in Latin, as in lactate and lactose. Many Madonna Lactans paintings are quite suggestive. The baby Jesus is sometimes depicted as a naughty schoolboy who looks directly at the viewer whilst nursing, or tugging and gripping at his mother's breasts. One very unusual and strangely beautiful example was painted by the artist Jean Fouquet. Created in the mid-15th century, it's uncannily modern, something an AI might generate. A marble-white Madonna sits imperiously and cold like a sculpture on a bejeweled throne. Six bright red and three bright blue angels attend to her in the background. She wears an exquisite crown on her head, and is dressed in a blue gown with an unlaced bodice that exposes her left breast. The depiction of her anatomy isn't natural. The breast is a perfect sphere, evocative of the robot from Fritz Lang's Metropolis. An ermine cape flows behind the figure of the Virgin Mary, The fabric from the cape wraps around her left side to rest in folds on her lap, forming a seat for the baby Jesus, who stares at and points to something to our left. Both the fabric and the Christ figure are white like the Madonna, cold, stone still. This painting is at the Royal Museum of Fine Arts in Antwerp. A link to it is on the Saint Podcast website. The Madonna Lactans by Jean Fouquet was commissioned by King Charles VII of France. The model is a woman named Agnes Sorel, the king's mistress, the love of his life and one of the great beauties of her age. As you can imagine, this portrait of a courtesan as the Virgin Mary caused quite the scandal. We'll return to King Charles VII in a future Mystics episode. He's the king that Joan of Arc fought for. The faithful through the ages projected the loves of their lives, as well as their infatuations, onto the images of sacred figures. Divinities whose hagiographies easily lent themselves to sensual depictions were the most common. Saint Sebastian, a shirtless man tied to a post. Mary Magdalene, a sinner repenting for her deeds. John the Baptist, an innocent shepherd boy barely covered by a loincloth. Saints whose stories drew attention to admirable qualities like strength and intelligence were also popular. Many lovers were depicted as Saint Catherine of Alexandria, the brightest mind of her generation, whom we covered in a Martyrs episode. Also popular was the Jewish heroine Judith mentioned earlier, who single-handedly defeated the invader general Holofernes. The painter Cristofano Allori was smitten by a fiery courtesan named Maria di Giovanni Mazzafidi, also known as La Mazzafida. La Mazzafida was a strong personality and had a huge destabilizing influence on the young painter. Allori painted La Mazzafida as another Saint Catherine, a saint we'll be covering in the Mystic series, Catherine of Siena. As Catherine of Siena, La Mazzafida is repentant. Her eyes are red from weeping for her sins. Cristofano's portrait of his lover as Judith paints quite a different picture. It's like a celebration of her formidable personality. You can sense her strength, her intelligence by the way she looks at the viewer, by the way she holds the head of Holofernes by the hair, a hard-won trophy from an act of war. The line between sacred and carnal love was often blurry. Friar Bartolomeo, a Dominican who died in 1517, was commissioned by the Church of San Marco in Florence to create a Saint Sebastian painting to hang in an altar. The friar was inspired by Jacopo Sansovino's contemporaneous sculpture of Bacchus, the Roman god of wine and carnal pleasure. Bacchus is depicted as a well-formed youth, nude with his left arm raised in a toast, a vessel of wine in hand. Bartolomeo's Sebastian copies this pose. The saint is more mature than the Bacchus sculpture, more muscular. He looks as if he's stepping out of an alcove with his left foot in midair. His right arm is raised instead of the left, and instead of wine, the saint holds a palm leaf, a symbol of martyrdom. An angel flies above Sebastian, handing him the palm frond. Ropes are wrapped around Sebastian's biceps. His left arm is still tied behind his back, but the motion in the pose suggests he's just broken free. Two arrows pierce the torso on the left side. A barely visible veil seems to momentarily cover his genitalia as it floats by. According to legend, Friar Bartolomeo's Saint Sebastian painting at the Church of San Marco was removed shortly after it debuted. Priests were shocked to learn from the confessional that the image of the naked martyr elicited impure thoughts during Mass. Sadly, the painting has since been lost. We've explored how Christian figures are linked to romantic love and cast as objects of mortal desire. Where among them, though, is the official patron saint of love and lovers, Saint Valentine? Why hasn't anyone painted their lover as this saint, or included him in a romantic devotional painting, maybe gazing down from heaven to bless the union of a worthy couple? The thing is, St. Valentine never had any association with love, not until about 1,000 years after his death. It's unlikely he's even an actual person, more of an amalgamation of 3 3rd-century saints all named Valentine, an Italian bishop, a Roman priest, and a martyr who died with his companions in Roman North Africa. There are other St. Valentines as well, about whom we have even less information, for a total of 11 saints named Valentine recognized by the Catholic Church. The name Valentine is an anglicized version of the Latin name Valentinus. It was popular until about the 7th century and means strong, vigorous, healthy. Valentinus is derived from the same Latin root word as value, valid, and valor. Saint Valentine is absent in the earliest surviving martyrology, a list of martyrs called the Chronograph of 354. The compiler of this ancient document was named Valentinus, so it's unlikely the omission was accidental. The first recorded mention of Saint Valentine doesn't appear for at least another 100 years. It's in a martyrology compiled sometime between the years 460 and 544. According to the earliest surviving sources, Valentine is a Roman citizen born in the year 226 in a village that is now Terni, Italy. We know nothing about Valentine's childhood. About his adulthood, we have 2 main stories. He either becomes a priest in Rome or a bishop of Terni. In both versions, Valentine's Christian faith sees him arrested during a period of Christian persecution under an emperor Claudius. There's no historical record of Christian persecutions under any emperor named Claudius, except one mention by the 1st century historian Suetonius that Claudius I expelled Jews who worshipped Christ from Rome. But Claudius I is a 1st century Roman emperor who reigned more than 150 years before Valentine's birth. Claudius II becomes emperor 1 year before Valentine dies. He also doesn't match the Claudius reference in hagiographies, though. If this Claudius had it out for anyone, it was the Germanic tribes, known collectively as the Alemanni. Emperor Claudius II is remembered for the successful battles he waged against the Alemanni. This all said, in 257, when Valentine would have been 31, Claudius II's predecessor, Emperor Valerian, did persecute Christians. He ordered all Christian clergy to perform sacrifices to the Roman gods or face censure, even death. Christians were also forbidden by Valerian from meeting in cemeteries. The Christian custom of burying the dead near a place of worship, in a churchyard, was very unusual. Roman customs favored the creation of cities of the dead, necropolises outside the city walls. Emperor Valerian couldn't have executed Valentine, though, because Valerian dies a few years before Valentine does. No matter the reigning emperor, Valentine gets arrested for being a Christian. This is where his legend diverges. Valentine, the priest of Rome, is placed under house arrest by Judge Asterius. The judge has heard rumors of miraculous healing powers Valentine is said to possess. He orders his prisoner to restore sight to his blind daughter. Sometimes she's referred to as an adopted daughter. Her name is Julia. Valentine places both hands over Julia's eyes and prays. When he removes them, Julia can see. The judge converts to Christianity, as do 46 members of his family. He also frees the Christians imprisoned in his jurisdiction. Valentine advises the judge that he must destroy all idols in his home, then fast for 3 days, after which he and his entire family will be baptized and become real Christians. News of the judge's defection reaches the emperor. He isn't pleased. Valentine is promptly arrested and commanded to give offerings to the Roman pantheon of gods. Valentine refuses. He's executed, along with Judge Asterius. A slightly different version of this story about Valentine, the priest of Rome, doesn't connect the conversion of Judge Asterius to Valentine's arrest. Instead, the saint is simply rounded up sometime later with other Christians while preaching in Rome. In this version, Valentine meets the emperor and suffers the same fate after admonishing the monarch to convert to Christianity. Later hagiographies expand on Valentine's suffering. The emperor's Praetorian guards drag the priest to the Flaminian Gate, which today is the Porta del Popolo, where Valentine is beaten, stoned, then beheaded. According to a 12th century hagiography, St. Valentine's head performs many miracles. It banishes a pestilence of mice from a field and calls rain to a drought-stricken area. The dismembered head of St. Valentine the priest cures the plague, heals the blind, the deaf, and the mute. The story of St. Valentine the bishop involves a pagan scholar named Crato. Here is a passage from academic Jack B. Orush's paper, St. Valentine, Chaucer, and Spring in February.
The narrative tells of a scholar named Crato, whose only son, Caraimon, has been crippled since the age of 3 by a disease that contorts his body, forcing his head between his knees and depriving him of speech. Upon learning from one Fonteos that Bishop Valentine has cured a similar case, Crato sends for him, and when Valentine arrives, offers him half of his wealth. But the bishop replies that the boy will only be cured if Crato believes in Christ.
Valentine attempts in vain to convert Crato to Christianity. Determined to save the boy nevertheless, the bishop locks himself away with the ailing son for a night, after procuring promises from the father and the entire household to convert if the healing is successful. Voices singing to the Christian God can be heard behind the closed doors. Upon daybreak, the son emerges completely healed. It's due to this miraculous cure that St. Valentine is the patron saint of the falling sickness, known today as epilepsy. The epileptic boy's family all convert to Christianity, as do Crato's colleagues and the son of a Praetorian prefect named Furiosus Placidus. The name is an interesting pairing of the words furious and placid. Roman senators hear of this mass conversion and arrest the bishop responsible. Valentine is executed. Crato and the other newly converted scholars secretly rescue Valentine's body to give the bishop a Christian burial. They're all subsequently rounded up and executed. The feast day of St. Valentine on the 14th of February is established by Pope Gelasius I in the year 496 as a date to pray to and honor the martyr saint. There's no link to love. Not for almost 1,000 years, until the English poet Geoffrey Chaucer composes A Parliament of Fowls, sometime between 1380 and 1390. The poem follows a narrator who falls asleep while reading Cicero's Dream of Scipio from the 1st century BCE. Dream of Scipio describes a vision of the Roman general Scipio Aemilianus. Once asleep, the narrator has his own vision. He journeys through a beautiful landscape in which he encounters allegorical figures that demonstrate both the wonderful and horrible aspects of love. Next, he wanders into the very erotic Temple of Venus, decorated by the likenesses of famous figures who suffered for love. Then at last, he encounters Venus herself. He resists her charms to exit into the sunlight. Once outside, the narrator sees nature. She presides over a flock of multiple birds, at least one of every imaginable species. They're gathered today on St. Valentine's Day to select mates. The words St. Valentine's are spelled with the letter Y instead of I. The birds hold a debate, which gives the poem its name. The various species represent different viewpoints from English society. The question up for discussion at this parliament is which of the three male eagles the female eagle should choose as her mate. After all arguments are heard, the female decides to defer her decision for a year. The eagles remain single while the other birds pair off and sing a song to welcome the coming spring. The narrator wakes up and returns to his book. Chaucer's poem is the earliest surviving text that links St. Valentine to love. In this case, a satire in which the lovers are birds. Jack B. Orush proposes quite convincingly that Chaucer invents this association. No such link exists prior to A Parliament of Fowls. Decades later, inspired by Chaucer, King Charles VI of France launches a monthly literary salon for happy recreation and lively conversation. The first meeting takes place on the 14th of February in the year 1400, and sees 600 courtiers discuss and debate matters of love through poetry, music, literature, with plenty of food and refreshment to lubricate the discourse. Incidentally, King Charles VI is the father of Charles VII, the monarch who commissioned the scandalous portrait of his mistress as the Virgin Mary from Jean Fouquet. One courtier who was intimately involved with King Charles VI's literary salon, called the Court of Love, is Christine de Pizan. She's the chief writer at the French court and composes Le Dit de la Rose, The Tale of the Rose, likely a fictional account of the founding of the Order of the Rose on the 14th of February by Louis of Orléans, the younger brother of Charles VI. De Pizan would author several St. Valentine-themed works, as well as publications advising princes and knights on proper behavior and just rule, satirical poetry about courtly life, and biographies. Pizan is perhaps best known for The Book of the City of Ladies. It's about an allegorical city inhabited by and made from legendary and historical women: Medusa to Mary Magdalene, Isis, the Virgin Mary, the daughter of Julius Caesar, Julia, and many, many others. The Book of the City of Ladies is de Pizan's rejection of another work, The Romance of the Rose, which satirized court life, but did so whilst depicting women as little more than conniving seducers. Another writer in the same literary circle is Charles, the Duke of Orléans. He's credited as the author of The First Valentine, the first message of love in which the beloved is called a valentine. Charles, a member of the French royal family, spends much of his adult life imprisoned by the English during the Hundred Years' War. According to legend, Charles of Orléans composes a poem to his wife whilst imprisoned in the Tower of London in 1416. The poem opens with the line, "I am already wearied by love, my very sweet Valentine." Historically, it's more likely he writes this back in France after regaining freedom, decades later. Nevertheless, a valentine composed whilst imprisoned and pining for love is much more romantic. It's sometime during the late 14th or early 15th century that an addition to the legend of St. Valentine begins appearing in hagiographies. Moments before dying, Valentine the priest now writes a message to the judge's daughter Julia, the one he cured of blindness. The note contains words of encouragement to strengthen Julia's faith in the midst of his death. He ends the letter, "From your Valentine." Another revision to St. Valentine's story during this same time period involves the historically vague Emperor Claudius. It's said that the emperor issues an edict that Roman soldiers are no longer permitted to marry. Married men are weak. Their emotional attachment to wives and children soften their ruthlessness in war. Valentine disregards the rule and conducts the sacrament of marriage between soldiers and their betrothed in secret. It's this act of defiance that leads to Valentine's execution, and further strengthens this new connection between Valentine and romantic love. In ancient times, Roman soldiers on active duty were indeed forbidden from entering into legal marriage. The rule was nearly impossible to enforce, however. It was also totally ineffective at curbing emotional ties. Most soldiers simply married in secret, or obeyed the rule, but maintained de facto family units with the same emotional attachments as married men. The interdict was lifted by Emperor Septimius Severus before Valentine was born. The development of St. Valentine's ever-evolving hagiography and the burgeoning literary genre of love poetry between courtiers proceeds hand in hand like lovers on a romantic stroll. In February of 1477, Marguerite Bruce writes a letter to John Paston in which she calls him "my right well-beloved Valentine." This is the earliest surviving English language Valentine, and it seems to be a heartbreaking plea from a woman spurned. She writes, "I am not in good health of body, nor of heart, nor shall I be till I hear from you." One century later, Shakespeare mentions St. Valentine's Day twice. Once in A Midsummer's Night Dream, which is a reference to birds pairing off, thanks to Chaucer, and a second time here in Hamlet. Tomorrow is St. Valentine's Day, all in the morning betime, and I am made at your window to be your Valentine. The lines are from Ophelia. They refer to a Valentine's Day superstition that if two single people meet on the 14th of February, they're likely to get married. Many folk traditions like this one developed as Valentine's Day started being observed not just by wealthy people, but by the general public. All involve some sort of matchmaking and divination of love. Here's a passage from Bruce David Forbes' book, America's Favorite Holidays, that describes the variety of customs that emerged.
These range from choosing a partner for a parlor game by drawing names out of a bowl, to plucking flowers to learn if someone's love was true, he loves me, he loves me not, to placing an herb under a pillow in hopes that one's dreams would show the face of a future lover.
The folk tradition in France is called the Lottery of Love. It resembles the Parliament of Fowls. On the 14th of February, men and women fill the buildings on either side of the main or high street. They then call out to each other and pair off based on voice alone. Once they meet, the men are allowed to discard any woman they don't like the look of and choose another. Upon the conclusion of the lottery, the unpaired women gather at a bonfire to burn effigies, tokens, and later photographs of the men who spurned them. The earliest surviving Valentine's Day card, a pre-printed love message delivered on the saint's feast day, is published on the 12th of January, 1797. The front of the card features a pattern of little putti, or cupids, and birds holding up wreaths of flowers hung up in the corners of the page by red bows. A sacred heart can be seen at the top. An oval at the center of the design features an illustration of a harvest or fertility goddess. Inside the card is a printed poem. Since on this ever-happy day, all nature's full of love and play, yet harmless still if my design, 'tis but to be your Valentine. There's also a handwritten message in the card. It's by Catherine Mostay to a Mr. Brown of Dover Place, Kent Road, London.
Mr. Brown, as I have repeatedly requested you to come, I think you must have some reason for not complying with my request. But as I have something particular to say to you, I could wish you make it all agreeable to come on Sunday next without fail. And in doing, you will oblige your well-wisher, Catherine Mostay.
It's in the 1700s that a still popular theory about the pagan origins of St. Valentine's Day emerges. In 1756, hagiographer Alban Butler describes in his book Lives of Fathers, Martyrs, and Other Principal Saints, one strategy the local clergy employed to Christianize a pagan matchmaking lottery.
To abolish the heathen's lewd superstitious custom of boys drawing the names of girls in honor of their goddess Februata Juno on the 15th of this month, several zealous pastors substituted the names of saints in billets given on this day.
About 50 years later, another writer, Francis Deuce, incorrectly assumes that the pagan love lottery described by Butler is the ancient Roman festival Lupercalia. Lupercalia is an ancient celebration to purify the city of Rome, restore its health and vigor. The name of the festival comes from the Latin word lupus, wolf, and it's linked to an even older Greek festival in honor of a wolf god who was, like Pan, a god of nature, fertility, and the wilderness. Lupercalia was originally called Februa, which means purification or purging. The word Februa gives us the name for the month, February. Februa, or Lupercalia, centers around a blood sacrifice. The priests of the Lupercalia, called Luperci, brothers of the wolf, sacrifice male goats or dogs. A feast follows, after which the skins from the sacrificed animals are made into thongs. The 1st century philosopher and writer Plutarch describes what happens next in this passage from his biography of Julius Caesar.
Many of the noble youths and the magistrates run up and down through the city naked for sport and laughter, striking those they meet with shaggy thongs. And many women of rank also purposefully get in their way, and like children at school present their hands to be struck, believing that the pregnant will thus be helped in delivery and the barren to pregnancy.
Francis Deuce promotes the idea that St. Valentine's feast day replaced Lupercalia based on an incorrect reading of Butler's hagiography. There's no hard evidence to support Deuce's theory, despite the fact that St. Valentine's feast day occurs in the same month as Lupercalia, February. Non-Christian celebrations were definitely repressed once the Roman Empire became officially Christian, but no surviving documents suggest a Christian day replaced Lupercalia. And as we've already discussed, no links between St. Valentine or any celebration involving romantic love existed prior to Chaucer's Parliament of Fowls. By the 19th century, the celebration of romantic love on February 14th is big business. According to Bruce Davis Forbes, 200,000 Valentine's Day cards are exchanged in London in the mid-1820s. By 1867, the number is over 1 million. It's because of the success of Valentine's Day cards that the greeting cards industry is born. By now, the holiday is no longer called St. Valentine's Day, but simply Valentine's Day. To most people, the word Valentine itself refers to a romantic interest or the cards exchanged on the day. Hardly anyone would associate it with a 3rd-century martyr. Although the pagan roots of Valentine's Day are tenuous, there are bona fide pagan aspects to modern-day celebrations. The ubiquitous heart is an ancient symbol. Its association with romantic love is a 14th-century invention, likely growing out of depictions of the Sacred Heart, a Christian symbol of God's love, divine love. Graphic motifs of natural forms like pine cones and ivy leaves also seem to have influenced the development of the heart. A link between love hearts and the hearts from playing cards, introduced to Europeans by Arabs in Spain, has also been suggested. The saint who gave his name to the holiday has never, as far as I can tell, appeared on a Valentine. His image has no place in a holiday about romantic love, I suppose, because the original version of his hagiography didn't lend itself to erotic or romantic treatments. He was never tied topless to a tree. He wasn't a corruptible shepherd boy, nor was he a repentant sinner begging for forgiveness. In the 20th century, St. Valentine did start being depicted as a younger man. Modern devotional cards show a handsome, bearded hipster in his 20s, not the 40-something who was beheaded for his beliefs. But the handsome hipster hasn't stuck. The modern face of Valentine's Day remains a pre-Christian god, Eros, the ancient Greek patron of love, called Cupid by the Romans. In antiquity, Eros was a handsome, muscular youth, often quite androgynous. The Roman Cupid was similar. Both were deities of love and sex, and divinities of disease. Love was considered a madness afflicted upon mortals by Cupid's arrows. We discuss the symbolism of arrows in detail in the St. Sebastian Martyrs episode. By the Renaissance, Eros Cupid had evolved into a winged baby, a puto, those little Raphael angels. Cupid in his puto form wasn't erotic, but became a standard element in many erotic paintings of pagan stories. The bare-bottomed angel accompanied Venus or Aphrodite in tales of love, infidelity, and lust. Their presence suggested a playfulness, a naughtiness. From the 16th century onwards, more than one puto, several puti, appeared in Christian paintings. They were decorative elements that held aloft garlands of flowers or ribbons. They tended to the long fabric on a saint's train. They supported the clouds the Virgin Mary and Christ stood upon. In Baroque Spanish and Portuguese art, the puti were reduced to smiling winged heads, often filling an entire composition, especially in sculpture and architectural details. Head to the Saints Podcast website to see examples. By the 19th century, the Puto was completely divorced from his pagan origins to become a baby angel, called somewhat incorrectly a cherub. In the Bible, cherubs are tetramorphs, winged figures that have four faces. Here's a description of a biblical cherub from the book of Ezekiel in the Old Testament.
Each of the four cherubim had four faces. The first was the face of an ox, the second was a human face, the third was the face of a lion, and the fourth was the face of an eagle. Their legs were straight, the soles of their feet like the hooves of a bull, gleaming like polished brass.
The baby angel cherub, who evolved from the pagan Eros, is today inseparable from Valentine's Day. Another non-Christian element central to Valentine's Day is chocolate. The civilizations of Mesoamerica revered the warm refreshment derived from the cacao bean. The deity Ecchua is an important Mayan god who gifted cacao to humans. Ecchua is the patron of cacao and the overseer of travels and journeys. Merchants and traders prayed to him and honored him because their profession involved the mortal perils of long-distance travel. The feathered serpent god Quetzalcoatl is the deity who gave the divine cacao to the Toltec people and showed them how to make chocolate from the bean. The Aztecs worshipped this god as the keeper of knowledge, crafts, and learning. Quetzalcoatl, the provider of cacao and chocolate, is also the patron of the Aztec priesthood. Cacao was very valuable across Mesoamerica. It was used as a currency of sorts, as was chocolate. Chocolate imbibed by priests and the ruling class wasn't the sweet, milky drink we have today. It was infused with chili powder, spices, maize, and peanut butter for a sultry refreshment. The drink was a special treat reserved only for the elite, the adult male elite, an after-dinner aperitif and a sacred offering to the dead. The gifting of cacao and chocolate to the gods was central to religious rituals. A blood-red intoxicant brewed from chocolate and mind-altering substances was ingested by warriors to banish fear. Willing participants in sacrifices also imbibed this chocolate elixir to prepare for their journey. Ground-up cacao seeds, flowers, and pure spring water were used in Mayan baptism rituals to purify the babies of wealthy families. The general public had access to cacao as a medicinal elixir. 19th century sources credit chocolate as a cure for ailments from headaches to cancer, impotence to lethargy. Eating chocolate was encouraged to maintain healthy teeth. The mood-altering qualities of chocolate were also widely promoted. It's still marketed today as an aphrodisiac. When the Spanish occupied Mesoamerica, cacao and chocolate were some of the first products exported to Europe. The first surviving mention of chocolate in Europe is in 1544, but the import of cacao across the Atlantic didn't begin till half a century later. The so-called savage taste of Aztec chocolate was tempered with honey, cinnamon, and allspice. As in its native land, chocolate in Europe was reserved only for the ruling elite. The first chocolate houses in the UK opened in 1657 and popularized its alleged healing properties, in particular to treat consumption, what people used to call tuberculosis. By the 18th century, with the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, the import of cacao and production of chocolate became cheaper and was now available much more widely. It was around this time that chocolate started being made into bite-sized pieces to be eaten rather than shaved or melted into a beverage. An early reference to chocolate as confectionery and in the form of a bar comes from the notorious Marquis de Sade. In a letter dated the 16th of May, 1779, the Marquis writes to his wife from prison, requesting a care package of cookies that must smell of chocolate, as if one were biting into a chocolate bar. The first time chocolates were marketed as a Valentine's Day gift was in 1868. They were produced by Cadbury, a confectioner founded by the Quaker John Cadbury in 1824. Decorative tins and boxes of chocolate were very popular. John Cadbury's son, George, came up with the idea to create a heart-shaped box. The lid features his brother Richard's daughter holding a kitten. She stands to the left of a red heart. To the right of the heart is a cherub. Colorful roses grow in a V-shape from the bottom of the box. The heart-shaped box was so popular it became a collector's item, where tokens of love from your Valentine could be kept safely and cherished. Several locations around the world host Valentine's Day celebrations, though without the presence of the saint. The village of Saint Valentine in central France holds a three-day festival on the weekend closest to the 14th. The self-professed Village of Love draws thousands to its lover's garden, where a metallic sculpture of a weeping willow whose leaves are hearts bears messages of love from visitors all over the world. After a stroll through Lover's Park, those infected by Cupid's arrows can write a love letter and send them via Cupid's postbox for a special Valentine postmark. The Valentine's Day celebration in the village of St. Valentine is a recent invention from the 1980s. Here's an excerpt from an article by Helen Page from her travel blog Travel Signposts.
When Pierre Rousseau became mayor of St. Valentine in 1983, he noticed that the community enjoyed the National Day of Lovers, which the village had been celebrating since 1965. But after the three-day weekend of enjoyment, and after the flowers that lined the houses had faded, St. Valentine was still an unknown village with no famous monuments, citizens, or landscape to boast about. With the assistance of his city council, he set about to build the Lover's Park, where each year lovers could come and plant a tree in the 4-hectare park.
The National Day of Lovers mentioned is the modern guise of the Lottery of Love we discussed earlier. If you'd like to honor St. Valentine himself on his feast day, you can do so by visiting one of the handful of churches that display his relics on the 14th of February. An altar on the left-hand side of the Basilica di Santa Maria in Rome houses St. Valentine's skull. If you're in Madrid, stop by the Church of San Anton, which also has claim to the saint's skull. The Blessed John Dunn's Scotus Church in Glasgow has possession of the rest of the saint's remains, kept in a bejeweled box. While the Basilica of St. Valentine in Terni, the saint's birthplace, boasts the entire incorrupt body of the saint, head and all. And lastly, St. Valentine's heart is said to be at the Whitefriars Street Carmelite Church in Dublin. It's a tradition in Dublin for couples to visit on Valentine's Day for a blessing from the priest and a kiss near the saint's heart. Long queues of couples line up at all of these churches on St. Valentine's feast day. They wait patiently, holding flowers, boxes of chocolates, cards decorated with cupids. They exchange these tokens of love after paying their respects to St. Valentine and receiving a blessing from the priest. Every now and then, someone pauses before St. Valentine's relics. They pluck one flower from a bouquet or one piece of chocolate from a heart-shaped box and leave it on the altar. Perhaps the 3rd-century martyr hasn't been forgotten, after all. Have a very happy St. Valentine's Day. Thank you so much for listening to this bonus episode, exclusively for Patreon supporters and Spotify subscribers. The readings in this episode are from my dear friend Bruno Portella. Bruno is a DJ and gamer from Lisbon who lives in London. Stay tuned for more bonus episodes, and thank you again and again for your support.